Both birds bounded from the open baskets on wildly clattering wings, and Ramon mounted the gun with such elegant economy of movement that he seemed casual and unhurried. When he had been in Mexico with his cousin Fidel Castro, he had provided much of the funds of the embryo Army of Liberation's war chest with his shotgun in the live pigeon rings of Guadalajara. So he also was a professional, with the marvellous eye and reflexes needed for the job. The first bird was going obliquely out, speeding on shining green wings for the wall, and he had to drop that one first. He took it cleanly with a charge of number 6 shot from the fully choked bottom barrel, and it exploded in a puff of feathers, like a burst pillow. He turned for the other bird, pirouetting like a dancer. This pigeon was a veteran. It had been shot at a dozen times before, and had kept low at basket level. The handler had plucked its tail unevenly, and although it was going at 60 miles an hour, it slid to one side and wobbled in flight. Instead of going for the wall, it came straight at Ramon's head, reducing the range to less than 10 feet, and in doing so making the shot many times more difficult. As it flashed towards his eyes, he had only 1/100th part of a second to react, and the extreme shortness of range would not give the charge of shot an opportunity to spread. It was as though he were firing a single ball, and an error of a mere fraction of a minute of angle would mean a miss. He hit the pigeon squarely in the head with the full charge at point-blank range, and the bird disintegrated. Its body was blown away in a flurry of bloodied feathers, and only the 2 separate wings remained intact. They spiraled down and fell at Ramon's feet. Isabella screamed wildly and came to her feet. Then, with a single bound, she vaulted the barrier. Although the rangemaster called sternly to her in unintelligible Spanish, she flouted range discipline and ran out in long, denim-clad legs to throw her arms around Ramon's neck. The crowd was already excited and volatile from the tensions of the contest. Now they laughed and applauded as Ramon and Isabella embraced in the centre of the stadium. They made a splendid couple, almost impossibly handsome, both tall and athletic, shining with health and youthful vigour. And that spontaneous display of affection touched a chord in those that watched them. They drove into the city in the Mercedes that Isabella had hired at the airport. Ramon opened an account at the Banco de España in the main square and deposited the winner's cheque into it. In a strange fashion, they shared a common attitude to money. Isabella seemed never even to consider price or value. Ramon had noticed that if a frock or a trinket took her fancy, she never even bothered to ask the price. She merely flipped one of her vast collection of plastic credit cards onto the counter, then signed the slip and crumpled her copy into her handbag without as much as glancing at it. When she emptied her handbag in the hotel room, she screwed the accumulated receipts into a ball and, still without reading them, tossed them disdainfully into the wastebasket or dropped them into the nearest ashtray for the chambermaid to dispose of. As a convenience, she also carried a fist-sized wad of banknotes crammed into her large leather shoulder bag. However, it was obvious that she had not concerned herself with the rate of exchange of sterling into Spanish pesetas. To pay for a cup of coffee or a glass of wine, she selected a banknote whose size and colour she deemed appropriate to the occasion and dropped it on the table, often leaving a waiter staring after her in speechless astonishment. Ramon had a similar contempt for money. At one level, he abhorred it as the symbol and the foundation of the capitalist system. He hated to be dictated to by the laws of economics and wealth, which he had dedicated his entire life to tearing down. He felt besmirched and demeaned when he had to wheedle and haggle with Moscow for the cash with which to perform his duties. Yet very early on in his career, he had become aware of the particular approbation that he earned from his superiors when he personally provided funds to finance his own operations. In Mexico, he had shot live pigeons. While he was at the University of Florida, he had imported drugs from South America and sold them on campus. In France, he had run weapons for the Algerians. In Italy, he had smuggled currency and arranged and executed 4 lucrative kidnappings. All the profits of these operations had meticulously been accounted for to Havana and Moscow. Their approval was reflected in the rapid promotion he had enjoyed, and the fact that a man of his age had been selected to replace General Cicero as head of a full section of the 4th Directorate. It had been quite obvious to Ramon from the outset that the paltry operating expenses that General Cicero had allocated for the Red Rose project were totally inadequate. He had been obliged to make up the shortfall as expeditiously as possible, and of course this little jaunt to Spain also provided an ideal opportunity to begin the second phase of the operation. That evening, to celebrate Ramon's win, they dined at a tiny seafood restaurant, jealously concealed from the tourist hordes in one of the back alleys where Isabella was the only foreigner amongst the dinner guests. The meal was an exquisite paella, cooked in the classical tradition and accompanied by a wine from one of the estates that had once belonged to Ramon's family, and whose tiny production was never sold outside Spain. It was crisp and perfumed, and had a pale green luminosity in the candlelight. "What happened to your family estates?" Isabella asked, after she had tasted and exclaimed over the wine. "My father lost them all after Franco came to power." Ramon lowered his voice as he said it. "He was an anti-fascist from the very beginning." And Isabella nodded with approval and understanding. Her own father had fought against the fascists, and she subscribed to the comfortable and fashionable belief of her generation in the essential goodness of all mankind, and the fervent, if rather hazy, ideal of universal peace, of which she was aware that fascism was the antithesis. She carried a ban-the-bomb button in her handbag, although it would have been crassly non-you to wear it actually pinned onto her clothing. "Tell me about your father and your family," she invited him. She realized that, although she had been with him almost a week, she actually knew very little about him, apart from what the Spanish chargé had told her over the dining table. She listened with fascination as Ramon recounted a little of the family history. One of his ancestors had received the title after he had sailed with Columbus to the Americas and Caribbean in 1492, and Isabella was vastly impressed by the antiquity of his lineage. "We go back as far as great-grandfather Sean Courtney," she deprecated her own ancestry, "and he died sometime in the 1920s. As she said it, she realized for the first time that if Ramon was the father, then her own son might one day be able to boast of such distinguished bloodlines. Until that moment, she had been content simply to be with Ramon, but now, as she leant close to him and watched his eyes in the candlelight, the horizons of her ambitions widened. She wanted him as she had never wanted anything in her life before. "And so you see, Bella, despite all of this, I am not a rich man." "Oh, yes, you are. I saw you pay over $200,000 into your bank account this afternoon," she told him gaily. "You can afford to buy me another bottle of wine, at the very least." "If you didn't have to fly back to London tomorrow morning, I would have used some of that money to take you up to Granada. I would have accompanied you to the bullfight and shown you my family castle in the Sierra Nevada." "But you've got to go back to London as well," she protested, "don't you?" "A few days. I could have managed a few days. Any sacrifice to be with you. You know, Ramon, I don't even know what you do. How do you earn your crust?" "Merchant banking," he shrugged dismissively. "I work for a private bank and I am responsible for African affairs. We arrange loans for developing companies in Central and Southern Africa." By now, Isabella's mind was accelerating up to racing speed. Ramon's lack of fortune was fully compensated for by his august origins, and he was a banker. There would certainly be a place for a merchant banker in the top ranks of Courtney Enterprises. It was all beginning to look marvellously exciting.
"I would like more than anything in this world to see your castle, Ramon, darling," she whispered huskily. And she thought, "I wonder how much a castle would cost, and if I could talk Gary into it."
Her brother Gary was the chairman and financial head of Courtney Enterprises. He was no more proof to Isabella's charms and wiles than any of the other male members of the family. Like most of the family, he was also a terrible snob. A Marquesa needed a castle. He might just fall for it. "And what about your father?" Ramon asked. "I thought that you had promised you'd be back on Monday."
"You leave my father to me," she said firmly.
"Bella, this is the most ridiculous hour to wake an old man," Shaza protested, as he answered her telephone call. "What time is it, in the name of all that's holy?"
"It's after six,
and we've already been for a swim, and you are not old. You are young and beautiful, the most beautiful man I know, Isabella cooed over the international line.
Oh, this sounds ominous, Shaza murmured. The more extravagant the compliment, the more outrageous the request. What do you want, young lady? What are you up to now?
You really are an awful old cynic, Pater, said Isabella,
and traced patterns in Ramon's chest hair with her forefinger. He sprawled naked beside her on the double bed. His body was still sticky, damp and salty from their dip in the Mediterranean.
I just rang you to tell you how much I love you.
Shaza chuckled.
What a dutiful little mouse. I certainly trained you well.
He lay back on the pillows and slipped his free arm around the shoulders of the woman who lay beside him. She sighed sleepily and wriggled closer to him, nuzzling against his chest.
How's Harriet? Shaza asked.
Harriet Beecham had agreed to provide cover for Isabella's expedition to Spain.
She's fine, Isabella assured him. She's right here now. We've been having a wonderful time.
Give her my love, Shaza ordered.
Oh, I will, she agreed.
And covering the mouthpiece, she leant over and kissed Ramon full on the lips.
She sends her love back to you, Papa, but she refuses to catch the London plane this morning.
Ah, said Shaza, now we come to the true reason for all this filial consideration.
It's not me, Daddy, it's Harriet. She wants to go up to Granada. There's a bullfight. She wants me to go with her.
Isabella let her voice trail into silence.
You and I are flying to Paris on Wednesday. Had you forgotten that? I'm addressing the Club Dimanche.
Daddy, you speak so well. The French ladies adore you. I'm sure you don't really need me.
Shaza did not reply. He knew that silence was the one sure way in which he could disconcert his wayward daughter. He covered the mouthpiece and asked the woman cuddled against him,
Kitty, can you come to Paris on Wednesday?
She opened her eyes.
Oh, you know I'm leaving for the OAU conference in Ethiopia on Saturday. I'll have you back by then.
She raised herself on one elbow and looked down at him thoughtfully.
Get thou behind me, Satan.
Daddy, are you still there? Isabella's voice floated between them.
So my own flesh and blood are determined to desert me, are they? Shaza asked in his most injured tones. All by myself in the least romantic city in the world.
I can't let Harriet down, Isabella explained. I'll make it up to you, I promise.
You'd better, young lady, Shaza warned her. I shall remind you of your indebtedness at a very near future date.
Granada will probably be deadly dull, and I'll miss you awfully, dear Papa, said Isabella contritely, and traced her forefinger down Ramon's body,
past his navel, and into the thick bush of hair below it. She twirled a dark curl around her fingertip.
And I will be desolated without you, Bella, Shaza agreed, and dropped the handset of the telephone onto its cradle, and pushed Kitty back gently onto the pillows. I said, get thou behind me, Satan, she protested huskily, not get thou on top of me.